We are in the book of Ecclesiastes this morning. If you're visiting with us, you've turned there. So happy to have you. It's kind of an impromptu series of lessons, so we have no lesson book. Just going to share some thoughts with each other on this book. We did an introduction 2 weeks ago, and then, of course, last week we had the power outage, so we didn't assemble here. But we've decided we've got 6 weeks to cover this material, and we have 12 chapters. So my math skills tell me we need to do 2 chapters per class. So let's keep that in mind as we go through the material. We don't want to rush through it, but we also want to understand that there are, somebody needs to open that back door there. There's a bit of a time constraint on it. So we won't go back into the introduction material. We'll just go straight to the text. And just say maybe a slight introduction. We talked about what the main emphasis of the book of Ecclesiastes is. Anybody have any input on what Solomon, I believe, who wrote this book, may have been really trying to hone in on when considering life under the sun? That phrase is used a lot, life under the sun. What's some of the things that he hones in on, tries to really single out?
No matter how much you search for happiness, riches, what have you, there's no real happiness.
No lasting, no permanent happiness. I think that's true. Somebody else had their hand up. Yes, Rusty.
I was just kind of going along through it. But you use that word vanity so many times. All the things in this life is really vain if God is not in your life to be the primary source that you're looking to. So you can obtain everything in this world, but we know Peter says this world and its works are going to be burned up. You can't take it with you, as we say. We just enjoy what God blesses us with each day of our life and thank Him for what He's done.
It is important to enjoy it. And to recognize the source of these blessings, but to understand they're temporary. And he focuses in on what never seems to change on this earth. There's a lot of repetition, right? And the disappointments we're faced to live with on the here and now. So there are challenges along this road that we're traveling on earth. Yes, Eric?
Can we more correctly say that without God, things in this life are purposeful.
And he draws that conclusion at the end. He takes us on a journey before he gets there. I think he could have just have easily done that at the beginning. Sometimes people do that with their works of literature or writing. They give you the conclusion, then they build their argumentation for why they've drawn that conclusion. He does it the other way. He paints a bleak picture and then tells you at the end, look, this is what it's all about.
So it's not just after death that we get to enjoy things now.
Yeah, and also that word meaningless, if that's indeed what, if that's synonymous with vanity, which is debatable whether that actually means meaninglessness or not. I think in some situations it can appear that way. Yeah, you're going to say, Charlotte?
I was just going to say, I think the book of Ecclesiastes is about balance. Balance in our life, we put God first, then the smaller, physical things of life are just the physical, and we can look forward to the spiritual and be spiritual.
Well, that's an important point, because are we spiritual beings or are we physical beings? Yes, right? We're both. And Are we bodies with spirits, or are we spirits that have bodies? I mean, I think we're spirits that have bodies, because that's the importance of this, right? That something is going to exist past life under the sun. and the body's not going to be it. John, then Andrew.
Yep. When Charles mentioned balance, he mentioned that the real wealthy people, they got that way by, that's all they pay attention to. They couldn't sleep at night trying to, but the laborer, you know, the regular guy, his sleep was sweet. And then he starts off the book by saying all this accomplishment and labor he said was vain. But on the other hand, the guy that has his life in balance, he's to eat and drink and enjoy his labor. So don't complicate our lives with useless things that we can't take with us.
He's so busy about doing the things he's supposed to do, he doesn't have time to worry about all that other stuff. Andrew. Definitely not meaningless, is it?
That's correct.
Not meaningless. So there's great import to what we do here on earth. Let's read the first 12 verses, actually the first 11 verses. I'll just read that. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What advantage does man have in all his work which he does under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Also the sun rises and the sun sets, and hastening to its place it rises there again. Blowing toward the south, then turning toward the north, the wind continues swirling along, and on its circular courses the wind returns. All the rivers flow into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place where the rivers flow, there they flow again. All things are wearisome. Man is not able to tell it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is that which will be, and that which has been done is that which will be done. So there is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one might say, see, this is new? Already it has existed in ages, for ages which were before us. There is no remembrance of earlier things, and also the later things which will occur, there will be for them no remembrance among those who will come later still. So, let's talk about this for a moment. Vanity of vanities. We talked about, you said that the implication of that is breath or vapor. Vapor is used. I know in the original New American Standard, they used meaningless terminology, but then in the updated version, they used vanity instead. Kind of hard to grasp exactly what that word means. I think it can have different meanings in even within the book and different in certain contexts, but I think the overall idea is that it is a vapor. Life is just a vapor. And you think about James 4:14 talks about that, where it's here for a while and then it vanishes away. And it's not only a vapor, it's a vapor of vapors. So that carries it to another degree, doesn't it? That's an exclamation point, a superlative. It's like you think of King of King and Lord of Lords, Holy of Holies, you know, vapor of vapors. So as the Holy of Holies is the utmost of holiness, a vapor of vapors is utter vapor. So he's really kind of emphasizing that life is, it's a blur, and events are unpredictable, often catastrophic, and it will come to a crashing halt at some point. Any thoughts on this idea of vapor or vanity or meaningless, if you think that's what it is there? Anything else on that? Yes.
So it puts in the scale of our lives.
And that's exactly what he does, isn't he? A generation comes, a generation goes, the world remains forever. Obviously, that's in relative terms. That doesn't mean that it will never cease to exist. But the world keeps on spinning, and generation comes and goes. And, you know, what he asks, what advantage does man have in all his work? In verse 3, what advantage do we have in all of our work? Huh? We get to eat. So we have some advantage, don't we? Yeah, I mean, there's something to it. It's not like there's no meaning to it. That is an important part of it. Who likes to eat? That's a sport I'm above average in, I will admit. But, you know, life is fleeting. And a generation comes and goes in the blink of an eye, it seems like. Don't blink. And the world's patterns are just as relentless and repetitive as the patterns of our lives, right? Generations come and go. Days march on. The wind keeps blowing. The rivers keep flowing. Same old, same old. Is it beautiful to behold? It is. Can you take it all in? That's another thing that he despairs of. You can't. You can't understand. You can't comprehend. You can't take it all in. And if you could, you wouldn't be satisfied with it because it's just a repetitive cycle over and over again. Yes, John?
This may seem a little morbid, but I've laid to rest family members, and I realize that their time has come and gone, and life just continues. So I would be gone one day, but life will continue. The world will still keep going. The winds will keep blowing, and everything will continue.
And if you have a very self-centered approach to your life, that's going to be disparaging to you, isn't it? But if not, that can actually be hopeful, can't it? The sun also rises. There's going to be a new day. We set things up for the generations that come after us, Eric.
Yeah, it is interesting that the idea of regularity can change our appreciation or bitterness towards regularity can change based on perspective. We just got back from vacation. We were in the mountains, and it's beautiful watching the sunset over the mountains. There's something about home and the regularity of home. So as beautiful as that was, there's part of you that longs for home. There's part of you that longs for regularity. You know, even if you are somebody who has a lot of wanderlust, or you know, somebody who likes to go and likes to do things, there is something about a schedule. There is something about a routine that is comforting to a person. But, you know, again, sometimes we get kind of bitter towards the routine until our perspective shifts. So it is about perspective,
that's,
I think.
That's what this is all about. You know, Griffin even talked about it. This is about keeping the proper perspective, balance. And most of us are creatures of habit. I know I am. But then again, things do get wearisome. That's what he says in verse 8. All things are wearisome. Beautiful to see, can't take it all in. It doesn't really satisfy, not for long. I did the same thing you did, Eric, a couple of weeks ago. I went up to the Smokies, and it was delightful. And it was just wonderful weather for, I guess it was February. And we went hiking up in the mountains, and there did you give me a defective clicker? Okay. Oh, now it's catching up. That was another title page I could have used, Finding Joy in the Fog. I really like that depiction there of it. Life is kind of a mist, isn't it? Things get obscured when we get lost in the day-to-day details of things, or sometimes we get bogged down by problems that occur. But this walking through this trail up in the Smokies is a beautiful stream that just wound through this countryside, and this path crossed this stream like 15 times. So Jillian had a big time walking across the rocks to get to the other side. And at the end of it, there she is sitting on a rock after we had our lunch. We actually had our lunch sitting on that rock. But there was a beautiful waterfall, and that we were excited to make that point before we had to turn back and lose all of our daylight. And it was beautiful to behold, really was. But, you know, it's really just a never-ending march, right? I mean, it was beautiful to take in, amazing experience. The sights and sounds were delightful. But that stream just keeps on flowing. And, I loved looking at that waterfall, but if I go back to that waterfall next year, it's just going to be doing that again, that same thing, that water continue to flow over that rock. Like the ocean, our senses are fed, but they're never filled. He said the rivers flowed into the sea, yet the sea is not full. We just can't be satisfied with it for long. And things, the more they change, the more they stay the same, right? The journey goes on, but we never really arrive at the place where we're wanting to go on this earth. That's not to say we don't make it to destinations that we plan out in our lives. We do that. But he says the eye is not satisfied nor the ear filled with taking all these things in. I will just want more. The more I see, the more I want. Either that or I'll tire of seeing it. And then, I will look for something else to do. Nature is beautiful. It's beautiful. I'm enriched by it. But that's enough. It should be enough. Now move on to the next thing. It's different but the same. Verse 10, he talks about that. There's nothing new under the sun. We just forget that those things have existed before. And maybe they've existed in different forms. You know, we have a lot of technology in our current day and age. So someone might say that we truly have new things compared to the things of the past, but is human nature any different than it's ever been? Are our desires really any different than human desires than they've ever been? He says there's nothing new, but in verse 11 he says there's no remembrance. We forget about these things. Of chapter 7 and verse 24 says, what has been is remote and exceedingly mysterious. We look back, a lot of us like to study history and look back in the great events of the past. And it's intriguing and it kind of looks mysterious, and then the mystery is solved, and then we can realize, that was a great accomplishment, but those kind of things have been done before. But hopefully this doesn't create in us a sense of despair. Hopefully it creates a hunger for something better, something more permanent. Anything else before we move on to the next section of verses? Okay, let's read verses 12 through 18. Eric, can you read that for us, verses 12 through 18?
I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. It is a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be straightened, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I said to myself, behold, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than all who were over Jerusalem before me. My mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge, and I set my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I realize that this also is striving after wind, because in much wisdom there is much grief. And increasing knowledge results in increasing pain.
Okay, so Solomon wanted to do it all. He wanted to see it all. He wanted to experience it all. He had the unique drive to do that and the resources, the means to carry that out. He was extremely wealthy, powerful, had everything at his disposal that a human being could have. But what was his conclusion in verse 13? He said it was a grievous task. A grievous task, a woeful burden. That's the only time this term is used in the Bible, but it's used repetitively in the book of Ecclesiastes. It's a dreadful slog to try to do everything, but it's also what? Is it possible? Is it possible to do it all? It's impossible. It's an impossible task. He says it's a dreadful task because it just can't be done. Who remembers the movie City Slickers? A few people, all right. So there was this enigmatic character named Curly. Billy Crystal was he hit middle age, and he had come to a point where he didn't appreciate life and couldn't figure out what it was all about. So he went to a ranch out west, and he met this fellow. And Curly gave some sage advice. Does anybody remember what his advice was? Yes, Andrew.
If there's only one thing that really matters.
One thing. I don't think he was talking about it in the context that we would. And obviously, I wouldn't want to limit our endeavors in life just to focus in on one activity under the sun or one goal or one ambition. But we can't do everything, can we? We can't do it all. Yeah, don't just try to do one thing and be the best at it and forget everything else. But don't try to do everything. But there is one thing that matters more than anything, is there not? And what is that? God. That's right. Don't forget your Maker. Remember the Lord in the days of your youth, before the evil days come, right? Remember Him when those days come as well. Because in the balance of things, when all things are weighed out in the end, that will have been the only thing that matters. So, and once again, he's going to come to that conclusion in chapter 12 and talk about this is the whole of man, the whole duty of man, and the meaning of man's existence is to fear God and keep His commandments. Rusty, and then John.
I'm looking at the International Standard Version, and at verse 13 it says, God used this terrible thing so human beings will struggle with life. I've never read it in that context translation before. But God does allow things to come up in our lives that we have to deal with that. We have struggles with it. And I think most of us can agree when we have our deepest struggles, that's probably the greatest time we turn to God and realize that into your hands I'm committing this. I can only just do so much as a human being, but you're the all-powerful. You can help me through this. Your word can comfort me, and I can get through these trials in life. And I think that's why we have struggles in life. Life is just a song and dance and frivolous hopscotch and all through life and nothing but fun, and we really wouldn't realize the great God that is in charge of everything that takes care of us, and these tribulations help us to realize those things.
Agreed. I have learned more from life's difficulties and adversities than I ever have from times that have produced no challenges for me. I like those times a lot when things flow along swimmingly, but I usually learn more the more meaningful things when life throws curveballs at me. Yes, John?
It's been a while since I've gone through Ecclesiastes. So the only thing that really that I remember was that last verse, fear God and keep His commandments. But all through the book, he mentions God, he gives God's perspective, what God's gift is, that, you know, that is to live a relatively simple life. And not to get things out of balance. So he gives God's advice all through it, and finally he agrees with God at the end.
Yeah, yeah. He takes us a twisty, turny path to get there, but that was his life, wasn't it? And a lot of times that's our lives. God bless the broken road that led me straight to you. That song talks about, right? Sometimes. You know, we have to, God lets us go through stuff, and we have to cross a lot of hurdles and sink down into pits sometimes before we realize what it's all about and come out shining on the other side. Yes, Eric?
We're coming out of this class on theology and trying to develop our understanding of who God is. And I think verse 13 is helpful in that regard, to say that God does teach us that this life is not it. And there are built-in reminders in this life that all is not well, that this is not everything, that this is not the pinnacle, this is not the goal, this is not the end. And we have these reminders over and over again. One of my favorite off-quoted ideas is from C.S. Lewis, that pain is God's megaphone. Now, does God want to hurt you? Does God, you know, is God evil and bent towards evil in your life? No. But can He use evil that's going to exist because of this broken world to enhance you and to deepen you and strengthen you? You better believe it.
That's such an important message for everybody, and especially young people. Keep that in mind as you go through the struggles in life. God is trying to teach you. He who has ears to hear and eyes to see will learn those lessons. It's not going to mean that it's going to make things easier even. But when we come out on the other side of our struggles and our challenges, we'll be better for it. Absolutely. Appreciate the comments very much. So he tried to do everything that life could offer him under the sun. Solomon did. And it was a vapor. It was vanity. It was striving after wind. It was like trying to grab a handful of wind. You reach out and grab a handful of wind and open your hand, and what do you have? There's nothing there. So he said in verse 15, what is crooked cannot be straightened. Look at my teeth. You would not believe that I wore braces on these teeth at one point in my life. And I willingly exposed myself to 18 months, a year and a half of pain and discomfort and humiliation to wear these braces to get my teeth straight, and willingly spent a lot of my mother's money, you may say wasted that, and there are my teeth all crooked again. And obviously, that's not what he's talking about. It's not anything as trivial as that, but I just think that's a good case in point. My crooked teeth could be straightened for a moment and they went right back to where they were. But what do you think the deeper meaning of this proverbial statement is? That which is crooked can't be straightened. Yes, John?
There's always going to be crooks.
There's always going to be crooks, okay.
You see, why can't people realize that working for a living is a lot more profitable than stealing it and begging it? You look at these people that live by stealing, and they have hardly anything. But the person that works, they've got a lot more. They've got a lot more peace. They don't have to worry about getting locked up.
Conscious, let them sleep at night.
It's always going to be a crooked way.
Yeah, that's one aspect of that. That would be one detail of that. Maybe a broader scope view of that which is crooked can't be straightened. I think, yes, Griffin?
As much power as reason you have, there's some stuff you just can't change. It is the way it is.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Something, we can't fix it all, can we? The world is a messed up place. It is. The world is always going to be a messed up place. And, you know, you can't straighten it all out. And no one can. And I know there are a lot of us here, we have that mindset, that temperament. We want to make things right for other people. Or for ourselves, and that's a noble mindset. I like to fix things. I want to fix things for people. And it frustrates me to no end when I can't do it. But we can't do it all. We can't fix it all. And, you know, we can't make everything right. What's lacking cannot be counted, he said. So don't count it. Rusty, what'd you say this morning? Count your blessings, right? Walking in the building. Don't try to count what's lacking. Count your blessings instead, and do what you can, and don't do what you can't do, and don't beat yourself up for the things you can't do. Yes, Lisa?
Like, we can't control it, but God can control it.
Yes.
So the way you just have to pray about it,
in every way, Lisa, not just in a way. That's absolutely right. Well said. Even the things we can do, we still need to pray to God to rectify things and give him the glory for even the things that we're able to do, because he's given us our skills and ability. Who, John, did you have your hand up? Who was that? Eric?
Well, and there's a balance too. I mean, this is a book of wisdom. I mean, there are certain things that you can't do in life and that you're accountable for doing or not doing. So, you know, there definitely is a balance here with respect to that.
Thought that just happened to us old folks. You'll come back around. The train will come back around. You think about that. Verse 17 says, I set my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. And I realized this is striving after wind. Why did he do that? Why did he set his mind to know wisdom and madness and folly? That seems kind of strange.
Well,
Eric got, wait, hold on. Eric got his thought back. We'll backtrack. Go ahead, Eric.
So, there's a difference between being constructive and being destructive. You know, if you have the heart to help, then you have the right to say something about something that's subpar. But if you don't have the heart to help, and if you're not offering solutions, then zip it, you know. The New Testament warns us about that. The idea of complacency, of course, Israel is a classic example of that. Just whining and complaining, and we definitely live in a world of whiners.
No doubt.
People whine incessantly, including all of us. We have the little things that we get into and the things that drive us nuts and the things that we whine and complain about. And we're warned about that. So we have to be mindful of that. You know, so there are some things that you can control, and there are some things you just need to zip it about.
Well said. I can't improve upon that. Why did Solomon set his mind to know wisdom and madness and folly? Were you going to have another comment, or are you going to... Go, yes, go right ahead.
Can't know wisdom without knowing the opposite side.
Okay. So he was trying to understand the enemy, so to speak, see the other side of things. I think that's a very viable explanation. I think chapter 7 and verse 25 may indicate that. I directed my mind to know, to investigate, and to seek wisdom and an explanation, and to know the evil of folly and the foolishness of madness. So I turn in chapter 2 and 12 and 13, I turn to consider wisdom, madness, and folly. For what will the man do who will come after the king except to what has already done? And I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. So it looks like he's trying to, he's doing an experiment. And he's trying to see which is best. Obviously, this should be a self-evident truth, but he wanted to experience it himself. Have you ever said, after you've seen something in the news, some atrocity or something, you say, how could anybody do something like that? You ever thought that? Solomon wanted to find out. He wanted to know. Kind of like to catch a criminal, you have to catch a thief, you have to think like a thief. I don't know if anybody remembers the movie Manhunter. I think it was the original movie with the character from The Silence of the Lambs. What was his name? Yeah, Hannibal Lecter. But anyway, the guy tried to get into his mind to try to figure out where he was and why he was doing it. That may be an extreme example of that, but it seemed like he wanted to know the dark side so he could understand it better. And he just proved his point. The light... wisdom exceeds folly as light exceeds darkness. Yes, Andrew.
This could also be a personal testimony that, hey, I experienced these things, kind of saying that, you know, I did the good and I also explored the bad.
Yeah.
And because I wanted to do those things. I'm not trying to have like a false sense of, okay, humility. I'm being honest. Mm-hmm. I saw things that would be ultimately pleasing to God, but then I also want the simple side of life. So you can rely on my personal experiences for me to be able to share with you, because what I have to say, there's something.
Been there, done that. I know what I'm talking about. And you don't have to do the things I did, right? I've gone through this and learned it for you. Don't even bother with it. I could tell you it's not worth it. And this, Derek Kidner wrote in his commentary, this is more than simple indulgence. It is a deliberate flight from rationality to get at some secret of life to which reason may be blocking the way. So, and I think that's probably true. And I think also when we read the next chapter and go on, when he says he set his mind to pleasure and to drink wine and to understand these things, I don't think he's just throwing caution to the wind. It's not simple indulgence on his part, I do not believe. Not making excuses for himself, like you said, but also I don't think he was just letting it rip and just letting it all hang out, so to speak, throwing caution to the wind. There was an intent and purpose behind the things that he did by his pursuits. Verse 18, in much wisdom there is much grief, and increasing knowledge results in increasing pain. That's another way you could look at it. The reason why he put his mind to know wisdom and madness and folly is because when the more you know, the more you realize you wish you wouldn't have known. I wish I didn't know then what I didn't know now, one of the lyrics of a song, a popular song from the 70s said. So that can make you crazy. You can spend your life learning and experiencing, and the more you learn, the more you experience, the more you realize, man, I wish I'd never seen that. I wish I'd never done that. Yes, Eric?
Yeah, it's an expression that those who don't learn from history, I do need to repeat it.
Yes.
And the second part of that expression, those who do learn from history are doomed to watch others repeat it. And so that's kind of another way of expressing his thought.
Life is just enigmatic, isn't it? That's really what this book is all about. You just can't figure it all out, and it's rather wearisome and troublesome, yet it's worth living to the fullest. All right, we got to get through chapter 2, and we got 10 minutes, so let's read it. Let's read the first 11 verses. I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure. So enjoy yourself, and behold, it too was futility. I said of laughter, it is madness, and of pleasure, what does it accomplish? I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine while my mind was guiding me wisely somehow, and how to take hold of folly until I could see what good there is for the sons of men to do under heaven the few days of their lives. I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself. I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made ponds of water for myself and from which to irrigate a forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves, and I had homeborn slaves. Also, I possessed flocks and herds larger than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. Also, I collected for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I provided myself male and female singers and the pleasures of men, many concubines. He really was crazy for doing that. Then I became great and increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. My wisdom also stood by me. All that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor. Thus I considered all my activities which my hands had done and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, all was vanity and striving after wind, and there was no profit under the sun. Okay, so he gave his mind, set his mind to wisdom. That didn't get him anywhere. That didn't satisfy. So he said, let's take a look at pleasure, the sensual delights. I said to myself, he said, in whatever verse that were, verse 1. Okay, who else talks to themselves? Anybody else? Yeah, Andrew? We get in trouble when we do that too much. And we all talk to ourselves, but we really need to be talking to God about the things that matter the most. A lot of times I'll have this dialogue in my head and I'll play things over and over and over, and it can be destructive. I need to be talking to God, and then I'm going to have some rectification to my problems. Yes, Robin? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very secular mindset, a very self-centered mindset, and anybody can fall into that. Even a wise person like Solomon, godly people like the people I see before me today, we can fall into that if we're not careful. It's the easiest thing to do is to become too consumed and absorbed with self. He tried, verse 3, he tried to mix wine and wisdom. Does that ever work, by the way? His wisdom remained. He hadn't lost sight of the quest, I think is what he's saying there. He just wasn't guzzling wine just to do it. He was continuing this experiment to try to prove to himself which was better in life. But it seems he wanted to experience both wisdom and folly, but he did so in like the way the average person does, maybe the way the average American does. Chapter 10 and verse 19, wine makes life merry and money answers everything. He was trying to find fulfillment and pleasure through the bottle, and it doesn't work. It never has worked. It never will work. Now, wine does make life merry, but does alcohol ever make anything better? You may have some merriment. What was that, Brianna?
Well, absolutely not. I mean, yeah, it's temporary.
Yes.
And then when you, the next day, you wake up with a split headache, and you don't remember, anything good that may have happened on whatever you were celebrating, really. I mean, it affects your brain, and that's not good. So many people, they go and, they drink, because they want to celebrate their wedding, or they want to celebrate this, or they want to celebrate that. But I bet you a lot of those memories that could have been had, they don't remember because they were drunk.
Yes, and it's a big picture problem, yes, Brianna, and it's really looking for fulfillment in situations that you're placed in instead of being content in whatever state that you're in. The Bible teaches us to do that, obviously. Yes, Lisa?
I was just thinking about that.
Right. Well, maybe that's why he needed to drink. Oh, neither one of those was good. Not a good combination, or individually by themselves. They're not good to have a whole bunch of wives and concubines and to drink a lot. Everything listed here, all of his pursuits, the gardens and everything, was to bring pleasure. Did it bring him pleasure? Well, verse 10, he says, let's read it. All my eyes desired, I did not refuse, I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart was pleased because of all my labor this was my reward under the sun. So did it bring him pleasure? Yeah, it did. It brought him pleasure. He did everything he wanted to do, and yet it did. It was still a vapor. What does Jeremiah 17:9 tell us? Anybody remember that verse? Huh? Well, no, but that's all over the Bible. He talks about the heart being wicked above all else and desperately sick. Who can trust it? Who can know it? Money, things, achievement, pleasure, it's all vanity. It's all striving after wind. Verse 12, so I turned to consider wisdom, madness, and folly. For what will the man do who will come after the king except what has already been done? And I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I know that one fate befalls them both. Then I said to myself, as is the fate of the fool, it also will befall me. Why then have I become extremely wise? So I said to myself, this too is vanity. What's the one thing that's going to befall all of us? Death, the great equalizer. No one escapes it. The wise, the foolish, the rich, the poor. Doesn't matter. You can just accumulate everything you want here on this earth, and you're going to go away, and it's going to stay here, and eventually it's going to be burned up. So he even said in verse 17, and please take the time to read the rest of this verse on your own. He said, I hated life. I hated life. Is that understandable? Have you ever been there in your life to say, I hate life? I mean, we get there sometimes. It's not a good place to be, but I think it is understandable, especially from a secular point of view. If you're trying to find lasting meaning from temporary pursuits, then all of it's going to be a dead end. There's never going to be satisfaction from that. He said in verse 18, he hated all the fruit of his labor. He completely despaired of all the fruit of his labor. Verse 20, he was abject disparity here because he finally come to the proper conclusion. Did anybody here need to hit rock bottom before they decided they needed to make their lives right with the Lord? I did. I had to despair of life. It took the Lord squashing me down before I realized I better turn to Him to lift me back up. So even at that, not all is lost. Solomon tells us, he teaches us, it's not too late to turn things around, no matter how far down in that pit you go. Read the rest of chapter 2 for yourself, and then we'll read 3 and 4 for next week, Lord willing, and we'll discuss that. Thank you all.